I'm Darien Abugaida. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, promises, promises. G7 leaders inflict more economic costs on Russia over the war in Ukraine. We take a closer look at some of the pledges they've made. Also this week, the import of Russian gold is banned by several nations. What might that mean for the market? As Sri Lanka's economic woes continue to hurt millions, we ask an expert how the country can get back on track. So leaders of the world's seven richest nations met in Germany this week to discuss how best to forge ahead during these uncertain economic times. The group of seven, or G7, includes Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the UK, and the US. The war in Ukraine, energy, global investment, and tech were some of the topics high on the agenda, and multi-billion dollar pledges were made. To talk us through the numbers is Charlie Robertson. He's the global chief economist at Renaissance Capital and the author of the book, The Time-Traveling Economist. He's joining us from London. Welcome to Al Jazeera. Thanks so much for speaking to us. So, Mr. Robertson, we heard from Germany's chancellor, who's vowed to keep the cost of running Russia's war in Ukraine high for President Putin. And also, what we know is that Russia is now making just as much money from energy exports as it was before the war. So the ban hasn't really worked on Russia. The G7 are now looking at imposing price caps on Russian crude. What impact do you think that is going to have?
Yeah, this has got a long history. If you go back to looking at World War II, and a few months after World War II began, the West was concerned about commodity supplies supporting Nazi Germany's efforts. And it even led to France and England considering bombing Russia's oil fields in Azerbaijan to stop them supplying oil to Hitler's Germany, who were good allies of the Soviet Union and the Russians at the time. And there was talk of sending troops across Sweden to support Finland in its battle against Russia and to stop the iron ore mines in Sweden supplying Nazi Germany. So this idea of trying to interrupt commodities in some way to impact war efforts on the part of the aggressor has got a long history. The big question here is, firstly, can it work? And there's a lot of doubts about this price cap as to whether it can work. And the second question is, will the Russians still supply oil at that sort of $10 or $20 a barrel price that's being talked about? I mean, I think the Russians are looking for at least $60 oil over the last 5 to 10 years with OPEC Plus. So there is going to be a question about the Russians may say, we'll just cut back the oil supply if we can't sell it at the price, the world price. And the problem there is that this really undermines Biden's chances for re-election in 2024. US presidents who lose elections, who don't get re-elected, it's always because of a recession. And that prospect is very real. So I think Biden's trying to save his job and stop the Russian war effort getting the support it's got. But it's very difficult to see how effective this can be.
Right. I mean, we've seen the war in Ukraine sending energy prices soaring pretty much globally. How difficult is it for members to sort of minimize the economic damage around the world that's been caused by these raises?
It's extremely difficult, especially given the scale of the fiscal deficits that already were happening because of COVID, and with inflation this high, offering any further support to the economy is also problematic. So it's really tough. And the answer would be you wouldn't want to start from here. 2014, we wrote that Germany needed to cut its gas dependency on Russia. Since 2014. Gas dependency has risen. So it's not something that can be sorted out in 6 months.
The G7 also pledged, they've set aside rather, $29.5 billion in assistance to Ukraine this year to help it close its financing gap. What might this look like?
Well, I imagine it's going to be some combination of EU support, US funding, IMF getting involved. There'll be some debt forgiveness along the way. I suspect they're not counting the military aid as that, but that's also extremely expensive. And $29.5 billion isn't going to be enough to support Ukraine. I mean, this is, maybe it's enough for this year, but it's not going to be enough on a multi-year basis. So I think there's going to be a long period of support. And people are talking about comparisons of the Marshall Aid plan, and that went on for years. This is the US supporting Europe after World War II, and it's going to be a multi-year effort with Ukraine.
And we also heard from the G7 that they want to raise about $600 billion within the next 5 years. That's for global infrastructure. What do you think this means?
Well, I think there's a number of factors at play here. First, there's going to be a bit of double counting. I suspect they're probably including the 300 billion euros of the EU Global Gateway, which is about supporting infrastructure and supporting kind of renewable energy. I suspect it might include the 50 billion or so in the IMF's Resilience Trust, the new kind of fund that's been set up from the special drawing rights. And that's supposed to be long-term financing to help countries achieve more renewable energy choices. And I suspect the West is looking to diversify the dependence on Russia. Russia on oil and gas, China for solar panels. I think the West would like to see the infrastructure in place, the factories outside of China that might produce the cheap solar panels that the world needs to make this faster shift to renewables.
You were saying just a moment ago that the $29.5 billion pledged for Ukraine, in your opinion, doesn't go far enough. What about the $4.5 billion that has been pledged to address food security issues around the globe? Is that enough?
Well, it's a drop in the ocean compared to the costs of food right now. Where I think that may be different is we put out a piece a month ago saying that that actually global wheat stocks are extremely high, and even if you assume that Ukraine can export nothing this year or next year or indeed the year after, you could still justify wheat prices falling. And I think what we've seen in recent weeks is the market begin to realise that Ukraine's difficulties in grain are not Russia's problems. I think Russia's export ban will ease soon. Russia and India, despite export bans, have been supplying wheat to Egypt, which is one of the biggest consumers. I suspect that we can see food prices still come down substantially, even without the G7 doing so much. So $4.5 billion doesn't go very far, but I think the global supply story for wheat is a much, much easier story for the world than the tight oil situation.
And what about those rising inflation numbers that we see globally? I mean, is inflation here to stay? And if so, for how long?
That's the trillion dollar question. And I don't have the answer on that, I'm afraid. All I think I was reading this morning, which is very relevant to this, is that if inflation doesn't come down in the second half of next year and into 2023, I think the markets are going to be deeply disappointed and are going to have to get rid of the idea that the Fed could be cutting interest rates already sometime next year. So it's really important for the global economy, as well as for Biden's re-election hopes in 2024, that we do see inflation come down over the next 6 to 12 months.
All right, Charlie Robertson, we thank you so much for speaking to us from London.
Thank you very much for having me.
So as we just mentioned, a spike in energy prices brought about partly by the war in Ukraine has hit the cost of living for millions. And experts don't see a drop anytime soon. Our correspondent in Berlin, Dominic Kane, sent us this report on how some parents living in Europe's largest and strongest economy are going hungry so their children have something to eat.
Nicole Gundlach prepares food for her children. They have been at school all day, and now back at home, they're hungry. But if their needs are simple, their mother's task is not, because putting food on the table is becoming increasingly more expensive.
So basically right now, with the food prices going so high, it's either spending two or three times on the amount of food or buying the amount that I could afford, and then we have to eat less food. So mainly it means, for me, buying less food, and I'm the one who's going hungry or not eating meals so that the kids can get enough food.
And that sort of stress has serious implications for her and for her children.
It's very hard on me because it causes a lot of stress. I'm always worrying. Sometimes I'm not sleeping because it's like, how are we going to eat tomorrow? Or what am I going to buy this week? What am I feeding my kids? Or even how is it going to be in the next months?
Rising food prices have implications for others too. Josita Hartanto runs a vegan restaurant in Berlin's Prenzlauer Berg district. The Lucky Leek has won high acclaim from the Michelin Guide with a reputation for fresh and seasonal fare with a personal touch. But maintaining those high standards with ever higher prices is becoming increasingly difficult.
Due to it, we have all the increasing prices for like basic ingredients, food and oil, everything. And of course it's a struggle. So for example, I had to remove my deep fryer because I couldn't get oil anymore. Just so simple things.
And the dilemma does not stop there, because the restaurant's overheads still have to be paid every month, meaning some hard choices have to be made.
All my suppliers increased their prices. So when I checked my bills, I was like, what? Yeah, and of course I had to compensate it in some way. And yeah, the only way was to increase my the prices for the menus a little bit.
These increasing prices are happening in many sectors of business and industry across Germany.
At the political level, many say the war in Ukraine is fueling inflation, combining a spike in energy prices with a drop in the supply of foodstuffs. The Chancellor says he knows it's hurting his country.
Millions of citizens ask themselves every day, will my money be enough? Will there be enough at the end of a month? These are very serious questions, questions which need a clear answer. The government has initiated extensive relief measures for citizens and businesses.
One short-term measure the German government has alighted on is cheaper public transport. Throughout the summer months, for a flat rate of €9, or around $9.50 each month, passengers can use local and regional buses, trains and trams to travel anywhere inside Germany. But some in the transport sector believe such short-term schemes are not the answer to spiralling prices. There were cuts, too, in the tax on fuel, but just a few weeks later, the prices at the pump are close to their pre-cut level. Such spiralling prices are common across Europe right now. This was a protest by pensioners in Athens. The common factor, rising prices and no rise in income.
As pensioners, we are facing a lot of serious problems every day due to inflation. At the supermarket, at the gas station, we get our pensions and within 5 to 10 days, the pension is gone. This can't go on.
At EU summits and again at the recent G7 summit, inflation has been discussed and it's clear leaders are trying to say, we feel your pain. But it's also the case, central bankers say there seems to be no quick fix.
Inflation will remain undesirably elevated for some time. However, moderating energy costs, the easing of supply disruptions related to the pandemic, and the normalization of monetary policy are expected to lead to a decline in inflation.
But some analysts are not so sure and believe the markets tell their own tale.
Almost all asset classes are in the red at the moment, and one can really feel how people don't trust the central banks anymore. You get the impression that the central banks have reacted way too late.
The last time inflation was this high was back in the early 1970s, when this wall still divided this city. Back then, a phrase was coined to describe the combination of stagnant economy and rising inflation, stagflation. For now, ministers say the threat of a return to that era is distant. For now. Dominic Kane for Counting the Cost in Berlin.
G7 leaders decided this week to ban imports of Russian gold. Sanctions brought in since the war in Ukraine began have aimed to crush Russia's economy and have included bans or curbs on oil and gas imports, as well as trading with Russian banks and individuals. Gold has always been seen as a safe haven for investors, and many turn to the precious metal to protect their hard-earned savings as record inflation hit other investment vehicles. Global demand rose by more than 30% on the year in the first 3 months of 2022. Russia is the world's third largest producer of gold after China and Australia and commands a 10% slice of the world's output. Gold is its second largest export after energy, and it's a significant source of revenue for President Putin. The G7 hope this latest move will isolate Moscow further from the global economy. Last year, gold made the Kremlin around $19 billion. So how will this latest move affect Russia and the wider market as a whole? To discuss all of this, I'm joined now by Kirill Kirilenko. He's a senior analyst with the CRU Group and specializes in precious metals such as gold, platinum and palladium. Welcome to Al Jazeera. Thanks so much for your time. So how significant is this ban on Russian gold, given that gold is its second largest export, as you know, after energy? And gold is an important asset for the central bank, which is already operating under limited conditions.
Around $15 billion of dollars, worth of dollars were exported to London last year. So obviously, Russia would not want to lose a quarter of the potential source for its military budget, and it will try to secure this money and raise them from other sources.
When you say other sources, what do you mean by that? Like whom?
I mean from other markets.
Okay.
Not just the London market, which was effectively already closed for the Russian gold since March.
So other markets this year, like who? Who could Russia turn to?
Russia could turn to Asia. Quite a lot of countries in this region are not supporting sanctions, at least for now. I think Africa and Latin America are also not many countries joined the Western sanctions on this country. Although London is a big international hub for trading, there are other markets where gold can be sold.
All right. So do you think this decision by the G7 will affect the market as a whole? And if not, why not?
Even if all the mines producing gold at the moment would be stopped, there would still be plenty of metal in the above ground stocks to satisfy the market needs. So in a sense, there is no physical shortage of this metal and it can be bought. But for example, if the sanctions were applied to the exports of palladium, that would be a different story because palladium is in short supply, the above ground stocks are low, and that would have a big impact on the market,
right,
for this commodity.
Talk us through why the public and investors buy gold, the commodity.
Well, the public buys it for two reasons. The first, in the form of jewelry. It looks nice, it feels nice, promotes your social status. And the second one, you can also buy jewelry as a form of wealth protection. So it's liquid, it's easy to sell later on. And in such countries like India, for example, it's a very popular form of savings. And investors buy gold because of its perceived safe haven status, because basically it holds its value. So for capital protection, gold has proved itself over centuries that it's probably one of the best assets to meet these goals.
And for central banks, why is it that central banks buy gold?
Sure. The central banks buy gold to diversify the foreign exchange reserves. So basically because gold doesn't hold any counterparty risk, so there is no one who could go bankrupt, for example. This promotes the role of this metal for central banks. And in the periods of increased market volatility and political instability, gold is also a good source of liquidity. And as we noticed last year and the year before, some countries were actually using their gold reserves to raise money to fund their vaccine programs.
So is that where you would put your spare money right now then? Where would you put your spare money, seeing as it's such a jittery, uneasy time?
Well, I would probably keep a certain portion of my savings in gold because it's still performed quite well in different currencies this year, not probably in the US dollar. It's only up by about 1%. But in other currencies, like for example, in euro or British pound, gold has delivered a robust performance over the last 6 months.
Thank you so much, Kirilenko. We really, really appreciate your time with us. Thanks for speaking to us from London.
Thanks very much for your invitation.
A delegation from the International Monetary Fund has been in Sri Lanka for talks with its government on how to help the nation move forward. Sri Lanka is looking for help as it goes through its most intense debt and economic crisis in decades. A shortage of foreign exchange has left it unable to pay off loans and import food and medicine. Plus, petrol pumps have almost run dry. Ruchir Desai joins us now to discuss the latest developments in Sri Lanka. He's a fund manager at Asia Frontier Investments over in Hong Kong. Welcome to Al Jazeera. Thank you so much for your time. How much trouble is Sri Lanka really in?
Well, actually, the economic trouble for Sri Lanka, I guess the economic and political trouble for Sri Lanka have been building up not just over the last couple of months. This is a culmination of the pressures that the country has been facing over the last 3 to 4 years. If you look at what's been happening since 2018, at the end of 2018, they had a political crisis where prime ministers were tried to, there was an attempt to change the prime minister at that point in time. In 2019, you had the Easter Sunday attacks, which affected the tourism sector, the all-important tourism sector. And of course, in 2020, you have the pandemic, which has really hurt the tourism sector even further the last maybe 2 years or more. And I think what's happened the last couple of months with the war in Ukraine, which has impacted both oil and also food prices, which Sri Lanka obviously imports, that was probably the final, I would say, nail in the coffin for the country, given the pressure that they were facing. So they went into 2022 on a very weak economic footing. And the war in Ukraine has just really pushed them into a corner at this point in time.
Right. And there have been negotiations going on with the IMF. What is the IMF going to want to see from Sri Lanka in terms of a change in its policies?
In terms of what IMF wants to see, I guess a lot of the economic measures that Sri Lanka has taken over the last couple of months has led to the start of talks with the IMF in terms of the Sri Lanka has allowed the rupee to float freely. So the rupee has depreciated by about 80% since March 2022. They raised interest rates by 700 basis points in April 2022, and also they've also increased fuel prices. But of course, these are just initial measures. A lot more need to be done in terms of having sustainable financial outlook for the country in terms of reducing the debt levels and also the fiscal deficit levels. So the IMF would really want to see sustainable tax revenue measures on the revenue side, and also the government cutting down expenditures. And that's what they want to see over the medium to long term, not just over the next 6 or 12 months.
Right. Okay. It's also received pledges of between $300 million to $600 million from the World Bank, and that's to buy medicine because, of course, there are incredible medicine shortages in the country. Is this enough?
Well, it's less than $1 billion. So it's okay to maybe meet your expenses for the next couple of months or couple of quarters for specifically for certain items like food and medicine. But this is not enough. I mean, if you look at what the government is saying, they're talking about needing about $5 or $6 billion over the next couple of next year or so in terms of meeting all their obligations and their import requirements. And obviously, they need these short-term finances from World Bank and from other friendly countries like India because of the fact that they don't have any foreign reserves to import fuel or import medicine. So yes, it's very important for the short term, but in the long run, they need something which is more sustainable.
Right. And in terms of fuel, we know that Sri Lanka is sending government ministers to Russia to try and negotiate for fuel as the pumps in the country run dry. Is this a short-term fix or is it a long-term solution, do you think?
The suppliers are not confident in supplying fuel to Sri Lanka because they're not confident of getting paid by the country. So clearly going to Russia and going to some other countries in the Middle East is clearly a short-term solution to overcome some of these difficulties that they face. But I think they obviously, like I said, they need a sustainable long-term plan. And over here, they need to build up their foreign exchange reserves in the long term because you can't sustain your country or economy by, buying oil short term for the next couple of months only. It has to be a more long term plan over here.
Right. And food security is suffering, as you know. Sri Lanka was also forced to import rice, the tea crop, which is the nation's top export, devastated. What changes do you think need to be implemented so that farmers in particular can survive and the public can start to get food?
Well, such kind of policies is just the example of the poor economic policy making of the government over the last couple of years. And it's not just agriculture. There are many other sectors which have suffered because of, I would say, short-sighted or a poor execution from the Sri Lankan government in terms of economic policies. I guess, obviously, once the situation improves, once the IMF funds come in, they can build up their foreign exchange reserves, bring back some economic stability. Then they can, have more rational plans for the agricultural sector and therefore help their farmers and also build back their food reserve as well.
Okay, thank you so much, Ruchir Desai, for speaking to us from Hong Kong.
Thank you for having me.
That's our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at DarinAG and use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. You can also drop us an email, countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. There is more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That's our website. It'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Darin Abugaida. From me and the whole team, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.